explicit construction prescription for the observables. Also, if you could not perform the whole construction to the end, we would learn something about the properties of Dirac observables if we have such a prescription. Now, we already know that an explicit prescription would be expression for the Dirac observables will be very complicated. For instance, Torre has shown that Dirac observables have to include an special derivative of infinitely high order in as expressions, as explicit space-based functions. So one could think that it's quite hopeless to obtain such Dirac observables, but one could say one resort could be some sort of approximation. For instance, Jorge Pullin and Rudolfo Gambini have proposed to consider an approximation for Dirac observables in the inverse cosmological constant. So here we will also do some kind of approximation, but a very general approach. And as we will show, we can also use these approximations to address conceptual issues. So one conceptual question would be, for instance, can we approximate the local observables of standard field theory in some way, and how good is this approximation? And for instance, one other question would be, will these observables have any kind of local Poisson algebra, where local refers to causal connectedness of the Poisson algebra. So one would expect that the Poisson algebra between local observables vanish if the measurements correspond to spatial connected regions. And this question suggests an expansion around a fixed background, where this background corresponds to the space-time manifold one is interested in and where one considers the field theory on. And this corresponds to an expansion around a fixed phase-based point. An application would be that deviations from standard field observables could result in fundamental uncertainties for our quantum gravity observables, as is, for instance, argued in a paper by Giddings, Marauf, and Hartl. And they, for instance, argue for fundamental resolution for fundamental uncertainty for the resolution and spatial distances. Another question would be, how does the choice of time and clocks, which enter actually our construction, influence the interpretation of our observables? And that is a question which has so far not been really addressed. So next slide, please. Now it's number three. So the overview would be that I will start to explain the concept of approximate Dirac observables. Then we will apply this concept to general relativity. And I will show how, in general relativity, one can interpret the observables we will get in terms of propagators and interaction processes similar to standard perturbation theory. Then we will shortly consider an example, namely a scalar field coupled to gravity. And I will comment on the commutator algebra of the observables and how does the choice of clock variables matter in this commutator algebra. And I will close with an outlook and a summary. So next slide, please. So here, as I already mentioned, we will consider an expansion around a fixed background or phase-based point. Phase-based point has to lie on the constrained hypersurface. And with x, I just denote our phase-based variables. And we'll introduce fluctuations around this phase-based point, denoted by a small letter x. And we consider the differences between our general phase-based point and the background as first order quantities. So So we can consider the components of small x as phase-based functions, which are by definition first-order quantities. So I have to introduce some kind of notation. So this as index to the left of a symbol will denote certain order terms, and an index in round brackets will denote exactly this order of this function g. An index in square brackets will denote all orders up to this order m in g, and with m plus I denote all terms of order bigger than m in this function g. And for instance, I can just expand the constraints in the different in the fluctuation variables, and the constraints will start with first order because I have chosen the background to be on the constraint hypersurface. So the zeroth order vanishes of the constraints.
Okay. Bianca, what conditions do you have on the coordinates? Are there any coordinates? I mean, this is basically a Taylor expansion, right? So what invariant significance does this order have?
So far, the coordinates don't have any conditions. So we will consider in the example, we will choose any coordinates. Yeah. So
right.
We will consider an example, but so far, I don't have any conditions on the coordinates.
Right. But you may choose one system and somebody else may choose some other system, and
yeah,
the orders will get mixed up, and that is okay at this stage.
At this stage, it's okay. So usually if one uses other coordinates, one will just get another expansion. So in the end, that will be different physical, at least different physical expansions. So one does count different things as first order if one uses different coordinates.
Okay, thank you.
Next slide, please. So if S is a Dirac observable, this means that it has vanishing Poisson brackets with a constraint, and I use this Wiggert equality sign to denote equalities which just need to hold on the constraint hypersurface. And now I can just truncate my Dirac observable F to terms up to the nth order. And if I do that, the resulting function, the resulting truncated function, will have the following Poisson bracket with the constraint. It will commute with the constraints up to terms of order m, so which are denoted here by O of m. And the reason for that is that I can write the truncated function as the full function f, which commutes with the constraints, minus a part which has all orders bigger than m in it, and this part commutes with a constraint, which is at least first order, up to terms of order n. So that just happens because the Poisson bracket kills two orders of the functions inside the Poisson bracket. So this motivates to define an approximate Dirac observable of nth order as a phase-based function which commutes with the constraints up to terms of order m. That's a very general concept. It can be generalized to perturbation and some kind of parameters, if one has such parameters, or perturbations around solvable sectors of the theory, like symmetry-reduced sectors. And furthermore, the first-order Dirac observables coincide with the observables of the linearized theory. So that justifies this definition. But one has also to show that it's practicable that one can actually compute Dirac observables of some certain order m. So next slide, please.
I'm sorry, Bianca, but on this slide that you just showed us, to get the equation that something is of the order of m on the other side, you implicitly assumed that your coordinates were in some suitable sense compatible with some canonical coordinates in the phase space. So for example, if my coordinate went as q squared, then this order, then the Poisson bracket on the right-hand side would not be of the order of M. So I think there are some implicit assumptions on coordinates that are being made.
Yes, yeah, sorry. So I forgot to mention that I misunderstood your earlier question. The coordinates I used on the previous slide should be canonical coordinates. So these coordinates are canonical coordinates.
Okay, so you're assuming that in the neighborhood of the point there is a chart and the symplectic structure is kind of has DQHDP form. And,
yes.
And you, okay, thank you.
Okay, so we are on slide 6 now. So how can one compute approximate Dirac service? So one first guess would just to try to truncate the constraints to some order. But the problem is if the order is bigger than 1, then in general, the truncated constraints will not form an algebra, and one cannot really find invariants under truncated constraints. Here, we use the formalism of partial and complete observables as suggested by Carlo Rovelli and generalized by me. And in particular, we use the series expansion for complete observables. And what we are going to do is to truncate the series to terms of order n, and in this way, we will find approximate Dirac observables. Now, if we truncate the series, we will see that it truncates to this, just finitely many terms. And so we have an explicit expression available for Dirac observables of order m. Moreover, if you use these complete observables, they have the advantage that they have actually an immediate dynamical and physical interpretation. So next slide, please. So here I will just give a short review on complete observables. So one way to understand these complete observables is as gauge invariant extensions of some phase-space functions. So to construct a gauge invariant extension, we have actually to choose some gauge, and we will do that in the way that we set a certain number of phase-space functions tk equal to some fixed parameters tau k, and this number has to be equal to the number of constraints. And then the complete observable associated to a phase-space function f can be defined in the following way. It has to restrict to the phase-space function small f on the gauge-fixed surface. That's on the gauge-fixed surface, the complete observable has to coincide with our small function f. And it has to be constant along the gauge orbit, so that that is just the condition that it commutes with the constraint. Now, so these two conditions define uniquely my complete observable in the case that the gauge is actually a good gauge. And the interpretation is that the complete observable gives me the value of the function f at that moment at which the gauge function coincide with the parameter values tau m. For this reason, I will call the gauge functions tm clock variables, because if I'm in general relativity, gauge transformation, the time evolution can be identified with a gauge transformation. That means values of my clock change, and if they coincide with some parameter values, I can say that this signifies a certain moment which is characterized by these parameter values tau m. Next slide, please. Now here's a short review of how to derive the power series for complete observables. In order to do this, I will introduce a new basis of constraints. And always do that as long as the constraints define the same constraint hypersurface. Constraint hypersurface as the old one, and this is in particular guaranteed if I can write the new constraints are some linear combinations of the old constraints, where the coefficients can be, in general, these functions. And in this case, the new constraints arise from the old constraints by applying a certain matrix to it, and this matrix is the inverse of this matrix A, which arises as the Poisson bracket between the clock variables and the constraints. And one can show that these new constraints, C tilde K, have a special property, namely they act as derivatives in the TK direction. That is the Poisson bracket between the new constraints and the clock variables TK are, at least on the constraint hypersurface, equal to the Kronecker delta, which can be easily seen because one sees that just the matrix A can't, is multiplied with the inverse of the matrix A. And from this first property, one can also show that these new constraints Poisson brackets, which are at least quadratic in the constraints, this has the consequence that the flow that is generated, or the gauge transformation which are generated by these new constraints, commute on the constraint hypersurface. So if we apply gauge transformations, we can do that in any order we want. Now, with these new constraints, it's quite straightforward to kind of Taylor expansion for the complete observables. And so that is written in the second part of the slide. So if one sees that if t is equal to the parameters tau, then all the terms cancel and just left with the function f. So I satisfy the condition that the complete observable coincides with the small function, with the function small f on the gauge fixed hypersurface. And furthermore, if I'm away from the hypersurface, I have to apply to the phase, to the function f a gauge transformation, which brings me to the gauge fixed surface. And that is actually done by this Taylor expansion, and one can check explicitly that this complete observable commutes with the constraints. So I get a power series, which is a power series in the term, in the differences between the parameter values tau k and the phase space functions or the clock variables tk. Now, if I just set my parameter values equal to the clock variables evaluated at the background phase space point, then these differences will be just, or will be at least linear in the fluctuations, so I get the power series in the fluctuations. The next slide, please. So if I expand complete observable to a certain order, the series will collapse to m plus 1 terms. So I get just finitely many terms. And furthermore, one sees that one needs the new constraints only to a certain order, namely to the order m, if I want to compute the m order complete observable. So of course, the question is whether the series converges for m goes to infinity. But that will heavily depend on the theory at hand and on the quality of the clock variables. However, if there exists a good gauge fixing at all, or a perfect set of clock variables, then one can always construct a Dirac observable which coincides with the approximate complete observable forms up to the order m. So in this sense, one can embed the approximate Dirac observables into the full theory as full Dirac observables. The main question is, of course, that whether such a perfect gauge fixing exists or not. So next slide, please. Now I come to the application to general relativity, and here I've done that in the complex connection variables. However, one can also choose the ADM variables or real connection variables. In fact, many of the formulas just apply also to the real case. So I have to work with the connection, which is the sum of the spin connection and the extrinsic curvature and the inverse densitized triad. And I'm choosing as a background, the Minkowski background with vanishing connection and the tide proportional to the Kronecker delta. So I can introduce fluctuation variables, which are denoted by small letters, and I can expand the constraints, and here I just have given the first order of the constraints. And I've done a mode expansion of these constraints. So here the indices to the left denote the different projections onto these mode subspaces. For instance, LL denotes the modes which are left, which are longitudinal in the left and right index. P denotes the modes which are transversal and has the trace part of these transversal modes. AT the antisymmetric transversal modes, and so on. As one will note that there appear all kinds of modes in the constraints, with the exception of the symmetric transversal trace-free modes. So these modes do not appear, but all other modes do appear in the linearized constraints. Next slide, please. So now we have to choose our clock variables. And a very convenient choice would be if the zeroth order of our matrix A, which we have to compute in order to compute the new constraints C tilde, would be just given by the identity matrix. And the question is whether such clock variables exist. And indeed, such clock variables were given in for the ADM variables a long time ago by exactly the ADM guys, so Arnowitz, Deser, and Miesner, in their paper on the ADM variables. And the ADM variables, you get a clock variable conjugated to the linearized vector constraints by considering the longitudinal modes of the free metric and a clock variable conjugated to the scalar constraints by considering the transversal trace part mode of the momentum variable. And one can translate these variables into the connection variables and just keep the first order, and one will get clock variables conjugated to the vector and scalar constraint. And furthermore, one has to find a clock variable conjugated to the Gauss constraint. So this can be done, and the result is depicted on the slice. And as one sees, I mean, these clock variables also do not contain any STT modes, so these symmetric transversal traceless modes. And these clock variables have the property that they are abelian and they are canonically conjugate to the linearized constraints. So I have exactly that the zeroth order part of the matrix A is given by the identity matrix. But I also will get higher order terms for the matrix A, which are given by the Poisson brackets of the clock variables with the higher order parts of the constraints. Now one can give the interpretation to these clock variables or to this gauge fixing, which they define, namely that the metric in this gauge fixing is given in a coordinate system which is as near to the Cartesian coordinate system as possible. Or another characterization would be that the first order lattice and shift function vanish in this gauge. Next slide, please.
At the linearized level, this kind of work was done in the complex variables in the 80s already. I just want pointing out some references later on to you.
Okay. Now I'm on slice number 12. The zeroth order of the matrix A is given just by the identity matrix. One can invert the matrix A perturbatively to obtain the new constraint C tilde. For instance, the first order of the inverted matrix is just given as minus the first order of the original matrix A. And furthermore, we can introduce yet another set of constraints, which I denote by C check. And these new constraints can be obtained from the tilde constraints by adding terms which are at least quadratic in the constraints. And these quadratic constraints do not anything, so they do not perform gauge transformations on the constraint hypersurface. So they don't change the gauge transformations of the C tilde constraints, which means that I can either use the constraints C check or C tilde in the formula for the complete observables. But they have the advantage that they are of the deparameterized form. That means the new these constraints C check can be written as the linearized part of the constraints plus a function which does not depend on the linearized constraints anymore. So it just depends on the STT mode and on the clock variables. And this form of the constraints has a consequence that these are completely abelian. See, the deparameterized form is easier to deal with. And from that, one also needs only finitely many operations to calculate complete observables of order m for the parameter values set to zero. So, given enough patience, I can compute the complete observables to an arbitrary order m. But the question is, can we introduce dynamics of some kind? Because so far, we have set the parameter values equal to zero, so we are fixed at some time value. So what happens if we change the parameter values tau k? Next slide, please. So for this, I have first to remark on the asymptotic conditions. When computing the complete observable, terms of the following form will appear. So I have to apply the constraint to some phase space function, and I have to integrate the result with the difference between the parameter values tau k and the clock functions tk. So for this purpose, I can understand the parameter values tau k and the clock variables tk are some kind of smearing functions for the constraints, and I particular have to consider the questions whether they are actually allowed by the asymptotic conditions as smearing functions. So I can specify asymptotic conditions, which are the ones taken from Tiemann, and these are such that the connection variable should decay as the r to the power of minus 2 as r goes to infinity and should have odd parity in leading order, and the triad should decay as r to the power of minus 1 and have even parity in leading order. Then one can go back to the clock variables and check that they have the correct asymptotic behavior to be allowed as smearing functions for the constraints. Here the parity conditions play the key role. But if one would like to set the one of the tau parameters to equal to some constant, particularly the one corresponding to the scalar constraint, this would correspond to choosing a constant lattice function, and if one chooses a constant lattice function, one usually has to add a boundary term to the scalar constraint. So this has to be done to cancel a divergent term which arises from the linear order of the scalar constraint. And if one remembers, the linear order is just given by a divergence, so actually this boundary term cancels the linear order of the constraint, and moreover, this boundary term is equal to the EDM energy. So if we use this constant parameter, we have to use this boundary term, and the corresponding constraint will just start with second order. And I will write this is function check h 0, which I introduced earlier. So in the following, I will just denote by check h 0 the integrated scalar constraint starting from second order. Next slide, please. Now we will just set one of the parameter value tau 0, which corresponds to the scalar constraint, to a constant. Now, because the constraints which I use are weakly abelian, I can rearrange my terms in the expansion, and I can rewrite the series expansion in two ways. So I will first comment on the first way, A. There, to compute the complete observer, I have first to do the following thing. I first evolve function small f. This is MT. And afterwards, I have to compute the complete observer or the gauge invariant extension with all the parameter values set to zero. So first I have to evolve. This is check h, and then I compute the gauge invariant extension. And this way is usually easier to calculate with than the second way. And the advantage of this way to calculate the complete observer is that the following, I can set in this Hamiltonian check h all the clock variables equal to zero. So as I mentioned earlier, there do not appear any terms which depend on the linear constraints in this Hamiltonian check h. But furthermore, I can also set all the clock variables to zero, and I am just left with the STT mode. The reason for that is that in the second step, I have to compute the gauge invariant extension, but for the gauge invariant extension, I just need to know the function on the gauge fixed hypersurface where the clock variables are actually set to zero. So this way of computing the complete observer makes it possible to interpret the result in terms of scattering of gravitons, because only the STT modes appear in the computation. Second way, the VB, is the following way. First, that I first compute the gauge invariant extensions of the function f, where I set all the parameter values to zero, and afterwards I compute the time evolution with a Hamiltonian check h. Which coincides on the constraint hypersurface is just this higher than second order, higher than first order parts of the scalar constraints. So it coincides actually with the ADM Hamiltonian. Dirac observer, I can replace this check h Hamiltonian with the EDM Hamiltonian, and this shows that the time evolution we are dealing with is generated by the EDM Hamiltonian. This EDM Hamiltonian generates time translations at infinity, so our choice of time corresponds to time translations at infinity. Next slide, please.
You refer to gravitons and things, but everything that you have done so far is completely classical.
With gravitons, I just refer to the STT modes of the field.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, so I'm on slide 15. So here we will have a closer look on the second order approximation. We are following the first VA from the previous slide, and there, for the second order approximation, we first have to evolve the function f, which I will assume to be of first order. This is Hamiltonian check h. I can set all clock variables to zero, so this Hamiltonian will just include STT modes. And I have to evolve it up to terms of second order. And in the second step, I have to calculate the complete observable, that is the Gage-Invariant extension, up to second order. And the point is that in the second step, I don't lose any orders, so I just need to do the first step up to second order. And for the first step, the property, since the first order of the Hamiltonian vanishes, we can actually define the free propagator by considering the second order of the Hamiltonian check h. We just will call it the free propagator. And then for the to compute the second order time evolution, I will have lots of terms where I just have the second order but of the Hamiltonian, but once I will have a Poisson bracket with the third order. And these terms can be rewritten in the following way if I use a certain integral identity. So I get the free propagation plus the term where the third order of the Hamiltonian appears, and the third order can be written as an integral. So first I have to evolve f with the free propagator for a certain time, then I have to compute the Poisson bracket with the third order, evolve the resulting fields again. So this is clearly from the form that the field f propagates freely, then some interaction process happens, described by the third order, and then the resulting fields again propagate. Generalizes to higher order. And this, in the second step, I have to calculate the Gage-invariant extension. So usually that just involves to calculate the Gage-invariant extension of the first order in the first step, because the second order is already Gage-invariant to second order. And in the second step, other modes than the STT modes will appear, in particular terms which will depend on the clock variables. This shows that the complete observable of a certain order m, here it's the second order, associated to some phase-based function and to some coordinates, t and sigma, can be explicitly calculated. And the first order coincides with the free theory. Next slide, please. Question is, how does our Hamiltonian look like? It turns out that the second order, that is the free propagator of this Hamiltonian check h, if I restrict it to the STT mode, coincides just with the second order scalar constraint restricted to the STT modes. So all the terms which I have to add to the scalar constraints are proportional either to the linearized constraints or to the clock variables, or in other words, to all the other gravitational modes. And I can set these to zero. So the free propagator, our free propagator coincides with the free propagator in the linearized theory, or for the meta fields on Minkowski spacetime. The same holds for the third order, and the third order of the Hamiltonian describes the scattering of gravitons or the STT modes on meta fields, or the other way around, that the meta fields scatter at gravitons or gravitons on gravitons. However, if you go to the fourth order, then we will have to add additional terms to the scalar to the fourth order of the scalar constraints, and in particular, this fourth order will include terms which include the inverse derivative operator. So this comes about because our clock variables had this inverse derivative operator, and this reflects our non-local choice of time. Remember that our time refer to time translations at infinity. And in general, we can say that this constraint as a Hamiltonian check H is not of finite order anymore, as opposed to the scalar constraints and the complex connection variables. Next slide, please.
Do you allow the complex connection and its complex conjugate as allowed variables, or does everything have to be written in terms of the self-dual connection and the triads?
So far, it's just the self-dual connection.
Okay, so nowhere in the framework the complex conjugate, the star of the self-dual connection, will appear in what you're doing.
No, but I mean this framework, I mean you can also use the real connection if you want. So
no, but I'm asking about the self-dual one. So in the self-dual one, nowhere there is a star. Is that right?
No.
Okay.
So if one considers gravity coupled to a scalar field, we will consider just the complete observables associated to the scalar field. And the first order, so the scalar field is already a complete observable to first order. And the first order coincides with the free theory on Minkowski background. And the higher order can be understood as the effects of gravity, and one can understand them as expansions in the square root of kappa if one would rescale the gravitational variable. Excuse me. Second order complete observable describes actually a scattering between the metafields and the gravitons. So to lowest order, it gives me the propagation of the metafield and the graviton background. This justifies approaches, at least up to second order, where one works with an effective meta-Hamiltonian. With this, I mean that one would set the gravitational variables have vanishing Poisson brackets with all the other fields, but one has to make the gravitational variables explicitly time-dependent, where the time dependence is just given by the free evolution of the graviton fields. This approach was, for instance, done by Hanno Salman and Thomas Thiemann in their computation of so if one computes the Poisson brackets, the metafields reflect to lowest order the causality structure of the graviton background. So I get a fluctuating causality structure given by the fluctuations of the gravitons. However, higher order terms of these Poisson brackets, or the higher order terms of, in general, the complete observable will include the back reaction terms, but also non-local expressions. With non-local expressions, I mean that the inverse derivative terms appear. Therefore, also higher order Poisson brackets will be difficult to interpret because of these non-local expressions. Yes, given the second order field to the scalar field explicitly, so there are three kinds of terms. The black term is just the free propagation of the scalar field. Here, these functions S and S prime just denote the propagator or the green function for the scalar field. Red terms arise from the gauge variant extension of the black terms. So these terms are explicitly dependent on the clock variable and just basically gives the scalar field on embeddings which differ from the gauge fixed embedding. And the blue terms describe the scattering on gravitons. So here we have the STT modes appearing, and they just describe the coupling between the scalar field and the gravitational field. And the G functions are just the propagators, the free propagators for the gravitational field. One can ask how does the choice of clock variables influence the interpretation of the complete observables, in particular the Poisson algebra of the complete observables. Here one would be interested in commutators between fields corresponding to different space-time points. And I will discuss two choices. The first would be to choose scalar fields as clock variables. So scalar fields give you actually a more local notion of time, because with scalar fields I can single out a space-time point as opposed to using the ADM clocks where I actually fix the rule embedding of one hypersurface into the rule manifold. For that reason, one would expect local behavior of space-time commutators. With that I mean that one would expect that the Poisson bracket between two fields corresponding to spatially connected space-time points should vanish. And however, if one considers the Poisson bracket between two complete observables, limit where for very short time separation, this commutator has some kind of correction term, one in Minkowski spacetime, and this correction goes as the energy of the field observed divided by the energy of the clock field. So energy of the clock field means here the scalar field one uses as clock. Basically this says if the energy of my clock is low, it gives me a bad clock and I get a big defective term. And if the energy of the clocks is large, this provides me good clocks. And this correction term is quite small, and I get back to the commutator algebra on the field on Minkowski spacetime. However, the problem with choosing the energy of the clock field very large is that I get back reaction terms from from the action of the clock field. And ultimately I will get black hole formation because of the energy of my clock variables. So this, for instance, is one reason why there could be a fundamental restriction on the observable or on the spatial resolution of observables if one uses scalar fields as clock variables. And if one chooses EDM clocks, the action term for the commutator as compared to the Minkowski result scales in the same way as the back reaction terms. The kappa to zero limit I just give come back to the result of field theory on flat background. I don't seem to have this problem with large energy is A. However, as explained on the previous slices, I get a non-local behavior starting with the third order. I close here with an outlook and with a summary. With Dirac observables, gives a dynamical interpretation, and furthermore, one can calculate explicitly the Dirac observables to an arbitrary order, and gives a precise understanding of the linearized theory, and I mean, in this sense, classical field theory, on a fixed background as approximations to full general relativity. And I think that this formalism can be used to address the construction and furthermore the interpretation of Dirac observables. And work in progress is so far that we can generalize this to expansion around symmetry reduced sectors or, for instance, cosmological sectors. And basically the strategy here is to use knowledge on symmetry reduced sectors to construct approximate Dirac observables for the full theory, or to include the Dirac observables of symmetry reduced sectors, or to embed these Dirac observables of symmetry reduced sectors into the full theory. As conceptual issues for quantum field theories on curved space-time from a new perspective. However, I think that we need a better understanding, in particular, of the quantum interpretation of complete observables, in particular, the role of clock variables. Thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
Okay, this is Abhay, and I have a few questions. Let's see. I mean, several things that you said today, which in general relativity, which has to do with up to second order Hamiltonian, second order observables and so on, was actually done in the 80s, and in particular, the result that one has the same Hamiltonian, the second order linearization or third order linearization of the constraints gives you the Hamiltonian, etc., is in the literature. But I think it is a little slightly different because there, one really used complex connections and complex conjugates of complex connections, and in your detailed formulation, you might not do that. You might represent the complex conjugate in terms of the connection and the derivatives of the triads themselves. So there is a technical difference, but otherwise a lot of these things were available.
This was Yuhan Lee, right?
Yuhan Lee and I had done it, and it's also in the proceedings of the Osgood Hill workshop, where in fact it was shown why the clocks in the complex connection variables were more natural than the ones that were in the ADM variables. I mean, Carol Kukash had a criticism of his own construction, and that criticism was actually overcome by looking at the self-dual variables. But the main point I want to say is that, and here is the question really. So, of course, one would say, well, why didn't one continue to higher and higher orders? So at that time, the general kind of intuition from working up to second and third order was that one was just translating in the Hamiltonian language standard perturbation theory about flat space-time. And if you plug in the dimensions of various expansions appropriately, you can also see that this is actually an expansion. Now, from my memory, this was also an expansion in square root of the Newton's constant. And so it looked like we're just reproducing what people were doing. I mean, it is good to reproduce, but still, we would be then ultimately led to kind of same kind of difficulties as those people were led to. In other words, we're not getting any new insights from non-perturbative gravity, even though we're doing everything canonically and so on and so forth. And I think the work that was recently done on propagator various places is trying to say what the difference is between the two things. So my question, Bianca, is that the reason why we stopped at that time was because we thought that, yes, we can develop this systematic order-by-order formalism, which I want to emphasize, we did not. We did stop at second or third order. But then the problem was basically that what new are we going to learn that people using standard perturbation theory have not already told us such as, for example, how quantum field theory in curved space-time emerges in this second-order approximation, and so on. In other words, we're just using perturbative Hilbert spaces in quantization. Gravitons there were really the Fock spaces and so on. So what new will we learn here that people who had done perturbation theory and showed that it does not work did not really get to? What did they miss that we will actually get here?
So far, I can't really say whether this perturbative formalism will be useful using this EDM clocks for quantum theory. But I try to show that one can actually learn something about conceptual questions, for instance, about these things with the Poisson algebra. And further work will actually generalize this approach to expansions around different backgrounds. And I think one can learn lots of conceptual things there. And for instance, consider the dependence on the choice of clock variables. And I think so far very few things are understood about the interpretation of the complete observables independent of the clock variables. And one can start by considering such questions like the clock, if one chooses Scalar clocks as clock variables, I get, for instance, these correction terms in the Poisson algebra. Does this have any phenomenological consequences? But if I choose these non-local ADM clocks, I get non-local terms. Does that have any consequences for quantum field theory or for the interpretation of quantum field theory? If I use these kind of non-local coordinates.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question for Abhay. You mentioned this Osgood-Hale paper where there was this argument that the complex connection was sort of well-suited as a time variable. And you said that Carl criticized it. Has anything of that changed with the introduction of the real variables, or is it the status more or less the same?
No, the other way around. Carl had criticized his own introduction of time and had pointed out why in geometry dynamics there was a problem. And using the complex variables, that problem, the specific problem that Carol had pointed out, actually goes away. I can say very briefly. Basically, the statement was that in the job, the time is really given by something like the Laplace to the minus one of HTT mode, so to say. And so the whole thing worked well if, in fact, you had, let me start from scratch, okay. It was not transverse traceless mode, it was a pure trace mode, okay. So the whole thing worked very well if, in fact, the time was really in the trace of the extrinsic curvature part, so to say. And the geometrodynamical variables that Carol was using, this could not be done, because the wave function was function only of the metric. And they could not see to make how they could make the wave function a function of the kind of the transverse traceless part of the metric, but trace part of the extrinsic curvature, so to say. And the statement was that with the complex variables, this naturally happens, because the complex variable has part of the extrinsic curvature. And therefore, if you go to the representation in which the wave function is a function of the connection, then time is really residing there. Just to summarize, I think I said it in a very bad way, but you would like to use a representation in which the wave function is a function of the dynamical variable and time. So you want to have a representation in which the dynamical variables, transverse spaceless mode, so to say, and the time variable are both in the argument of the wave function. And that was not possible in geometry dynamics, and this was Carol's criticism against geometry dynamics, and this was actually resolved with the complex variables.
But it's also resolved by the Barbero real variables as well.
I think
probably.
Most likely it is resolved by also these variables. There is one technical thing that one would have to check, which I probably checked at one stage, but I just don't remember the answer. But you're right.
Thanks.
Okay. Are there other further comments or questions? We have time. Anybody here? Jorge, do you have any announcements?
So the announcement, this is the last seminar of the semester, and we will resume in February, as I mentioned, by email, because in January a lot of us are going to be in Santa Barbara, and the time difference with Europe is just too large to try to have a live call.
Okay, let's thank Bianca again.
Bye-bye.